There are many stories of the long fight to free American people from bondage, either actual slavery or the second-class citizenship of women in the first part of our history. A new book focuses on three of the key women in those struggles, all of them, at one time or another, residents of Auburn, New York. Harriet Tubman, Frances Seward, and Martha Wright are the title characters in the book The Agitators, three friends who fought for abolition and women's rights. Dorothy Wickenden is the author. Dorothy is marking 25 years now as the executive editor of The New Yorker. She also writes for the magazine and hosts a weekly politics podcast for it. Dorothy is the author of one previous book and the editor of another, The New Republic Reader. Dorothy Wickenden, welcome.
Thank you so much.
I don't know how you find the time to write this book. What led you to the subject matter?
Probably if I had known how long it would take, I would not have undertaken it. It actually began when I was doing some research on my previous book, Nothing Daunted, about my grandmother who grew up in Auburn. And she had said in her oral history that her grandparents lived next door to William H. Seward and his wife, Frances Seward. And Seward was, of course, a great 19th century politician who ended up becoming Secretary of State to Abraham Lincoln. So I went to Auburn for the first time, and I went to the Seward House Museum, and my grandmother's story was quickly confirmed. And then I immediately became captivated by a story that I was told by the education director at the museum, who took me on a private tour down into the original basement kitchen, where she said Frances Seward hid fugitive slaves on an Underground Railroad stop. And she said that she and her great friend, Martha Coffin Wright, a middle-class mother of six, were complete outliers in a very conservative town. And they instantly became friends once Martha moved to town. And they conspired together against the subordination of women and against slavery, became ardent abolitionists and women's rights advocates. Then, in 1849, Harriet Tubman liberates herself from the Eastern Shore of Maryland, makes her way to Philadelphia, where she meets Martha's older sister, the famous human rights advocate Lucretia Mott, among other abolitionists in town. The two of them become close friends, and through Lucretia Mott, Martha meets Harriet Tubman, and then Martha introduces Tubman in Auburn to Frances. So that is the way that Auburn, which is right in the middle of New York State, became a regular stop on her Underground Railroad extractions. And the three of them, they seemed so different superficially, but they became not only colleagues on the Underground Railroad, but intimate friends. And they were absolutely in agreement about the two major issues of the age, which were that women and African Americans deserved equal rights.
And how well known were the efforts of Frances Seward and Martha Coffin Wright in their time?
They were virtually unknown. It was dangerous to harbor fugitive slaves in your house. It was against the law, and it was especially against the law once the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was passed, which imposed greater fines and possible prison terms on people who did it. So, and they were already, well, Martha, who was just wickedly funny and also just outspoken against all the conservative tendencies of her neighbors, they already looked askance at her. So they had to be very careful to do this covertly. And women at the time were considered beneath notice. And so in a way, that made all of their efforts somewhat easier because people didn't pay much attention to them. Everyone assumed that they were doing what they were supposed to be doing, which was cooking, cleaning, and taking care of the children and their husbands.
Well, and it's really interesting, too, how long that went on. You point out early in the book that a biographer of William Seward found the letters of Frances worthless.
Yes, well, that was Glendon Van Dusen, who was working in the Seward House, which was still a private home owned by the Seward descendants at that time. And he began his work in the 1840s, and he asked if about the correspondence and other papers of William Seward, where were they? And their grandson took him upstairs into the attic, and he was, what a gift. He opens the door, and there are trunks and valises and bureaus stuffed with the papers of this great statesman and with the letters between Frances Seward and her husband. So Frances hated Washington, where slavery was legal. She insisted very aberrantly on living in Auburn while Seward was in Washington, first as a senator and then as Secretary of State. But they wrote to each other all the time. And as the decades went on, she became more radical. And Seward, who was anti-slavery, especially when he became Secretary of State, became somewhat more politic, let's say, about the issue of slavery, because before the war actually broke out, he and Lincoln thought they still could possibly save the Union, in which case, you know, which led them to be to take some compromises on slavery. And so this caused Frances to send her into an absolute fury. And the letters, which, as you say, after they were donated to the University of Rochester, the first curator there put them aside as worthless. And Glendon Van Dusen, in his biography of Seward, just describes Frances as a neurotic invalid. So subsequent biographers gave her a little bit more attention, and Doris Kearns Goodwin in particular did quote from some of the letters, but they were basically just sitting in this archive. Nobody had read them, all of them. And so this young education director at the Seward House Museum had read some of them, and she said, they are really revelatory. So I went to Rochester, and I started reading these letters, and I thought, well, there's a story just in these letters. But I quickly found that you couldn't really tell Frances Seward's story without telling the story of this remarkable friendship with Harriet Tubman. And both Martha and Frances, Tubman, once she entered their lives, she became to them the embodiment of the abolitionist cause. Here was I think she was 27 when she liberated herself, walked out of slavery all alone, leaving behind her husband, who was a free man.
Okay, we'll have to pick up the story on the other side of a break. The Agitators with Dorothy Wickenden here on the Jefferson Exchange. We're back in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange and the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest is Dorothy Wickenden, the executive editor of The New Yorker for 25 years now, out with a book of her own called The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights. It's a description of Harriet Tubman, Frances Seward, and Martha Wright, and the friendship they formed in Auburn, New York, where they all lived, and which was a stop on the Underground Railroad, including stops in both of the white women's basements, Frances Seward and Martha Wright, which is really hard for Frances Seward when you think about it, because her husband was William Seward, you know, Seward's Folly, who was governor and senator from the state of New York and then Secretary of State under Lincoln. A busy fella, very much in the public spotlight, and yet this all went on, and the stories are just amazing, and we'll explore them further in this hour. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So pick up where you were just a moment ago. Harriet Tubman then left her husband behind on the eastern shore of Maryland when she got out of slavery.
Yes, and she developed, it's really a network. I mean, the Underground Railroad was such a tight network of people you had to trust at every step of the way. And so two of her key contacts were these two women in Auburn. And when they met her, it just became clear to me that she embodied to them the potential of abolition. This was a very important idea to them, but they didn't know well any of the fugitive slaves who normally would quickly come through and then move on to Canada. They got to know Tubman extremely well. They knew all about her family, and they became just devoted friends. And Tubman, among her many gifts, was a gift for friendship and an uncanny ability to choose extremely well among the people she collaborated with, and then ends up using to help her in her various missions, which changed over the decades.
Let's talk about the people individually. Harriet Tubman was actually Araminta Ross, or Minty, when she was born, and apparently somebody finally figured out her birth date just within the last few years.
Yes, well, that was Kate Larson, who has spent decades, really writing a scholarly biography of Tubman. It started out as a dissertation decades ago, and her interest remains. So her book was published, I believe, in 2004, but she's continued her research. And It was she who discovered, just by going back, endless research, going back to original court papers and other things, she kind of pieced it together that that must have been when Tubman was born. So Kate was a wonderful resource for me working on the book.
How did Harriet get from Araminta to Harriet?
Harriet was her mother's name, and she was known as Rit. And Harriet decided, you know, once she kind of outgrew her name on the farm where she was enslaved, she decided she wanted to go after her mother, be named sort of. It was a badge of honor to her to be named after her mother, who was another complete force of nature, who was very, you know, rebelled in her own way against being enslaved, and was part of the extremely dangerous underground network on the Eastern Shore.
Let's talk about the underground network, because there was something in existence before Harriet even got to freedom, it sounds like it. But did she just make the Underground Railroad much more robust?
Well, yes, it was. So it had been in effect for many years, I think totaling maybe 50 years altogether. And so this it completely perplexed slaveholders. One of them said they knew that people were helping their enslaved people to escape. They just couldn't figure out how. And one of them said, this is a labyrinth that has no clue. And it really was this incredible, successful experiment in underground democracy. So people who participated were white Quaker women, white businessmen, enslaved people, free blacks, people like Martha and Francis. So you needed to know people at every, you know, you would stop at one house and then that person would give you the directions to the next safe house. But every member only knew, you know, the closest contact. So that was one way they maintained secrecy and safety. So Tubman, as she was growing up, she never learned to read and write for obvious reasons. And she heard her first stories about the Underground Railroad from her mother and father, who were participants in it, in its form on the Eastern Shore. And she began, she worked a lot outside, and she began to talk to free blacks, some of them, you know, had traveled on ships to the north. She just began to get an idea, and she understood some of the routes that they followed. And she had this incredible memory, and she was able to kind of map in her own mind how this could be done. She refused to stay in slavery, and she ultimately developed this idea that she was not only going to escape herself, she was going to go back a dozen times and escape liberate as many people as she could, and she did it.
Yeah, it's amazing. Harriet Tubman, one of three people profiled in the book, The Agitators by Dorothy Wickenden. Dorothy's our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. So Harriet did leave with her brothers once and turned back. I mean, what was the circumstance there?
And she was quite funny in her own way, too. So she made it, and she was a gifted storyteller, and she told the same stories again and again to her friends in the North because she really wanted this to all be remembered and written down. And so as she told it, they became really scared along the way. They hadn't gone very far. And she was exasperated with them, and they didn't trust her to lead them safely out of slavery. And so they were more afraid of being caught by slave catchers, which meant sometimes death or branding or some other form of torture. So they were more afraid of that than they were of returning and then receiving whatever punishment they were given for trying to escape. So she had to take them back. She escorted them back, and she immediately discovered that there were plans for her to be sold to the Deep South, and she decided, that's it, I'm just going again immediately. And she did, alone. Her husband refused to go with her. He was a free man. He had steady work. He thought she was crazy, that this was a suicidal mission, and he didn't want to have any part
in it. Wow. And again, the story gets more interesting later on when she comes back on one of her many trips. I haven't talked about the injuries. I mean, Harriet Tubman bore some physical scars in addition to the emotional ones through her life from being a slave. And there was one injury in particular that stayed with her through her life. What had happened in that circumstance?
Yeah, that was really terrible. She started working when she was, you know, 5 or 6, but this was a little bit later. And on the Eastern Shore, they rented out, slaveholders rented out, you know, they considered them human property, so they would rent them out to other slaveholders. So she was working for someone else. She was told to go to the local dry goods store to pick up some supplies. She was there when a young enslaved man was trying to escape, and the overseer caught up with him, and he picked up an iron weight from the counter and threw it at the man, but it hit Harriet in the tub. It hit Harriet Tubman in the head, and it broke her skull. And she had to be carried back to the house. And it was a very serious injury. It caused blackouts throughout her life. And she had a form of seizures. And she also developed it's an uncanny, and I don't know exactly how to describe it, but she had visions where she could predict the future. And there are a number of times when she did this, and she turned out to be right. And everyone who met her was just heard one of these, you know, was subject to one of these stories and learned that it had actually occurred. They were all just amazed. And it was, again, one of the facets that made this woman this, you know, unparalleled American hero.
Truly that. Harriet Tubman, one of three central figures in the book, The Agitators, along with Frances Seward and Martha Wright. It is by Dorothy Wickenden, the executive editor of The New Yorker, subtitled Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights. And you can join our conversation here on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Harriet has plenty of motivation. Let's go back and pick up Martha Wright. I mean, what were the shaping forces that made her push through obstacles in her own life?
Yeah, she was a phenomenal character, too, in her own way. Her family went back to the original Quaker founders of on Nantucket, and that they were part of the more radical Quaker sect, what they were called Hicksites, and they believed in absolute equality between men and women. The women on Nantucket ran their own shops. They did everything that their husbands would have done, but most of these men were away at sea, whaling and, you know, and going to the Orient to pick up goods and so on. And they were gone for years at a time. So women just kept the books, did all of that, and they raised the children. And they also had this view that was, you know, extremely unpopular at the time, which was that slavery should be abolished. So Quakers, many Quakers were among the first to say that publicly, and Martha's ancestors and her mother were among those. So Martha grew up with this incredible rebellious streak, and she was partly brought up by her older sister, Lucretia Mott, who was a Quaker minister, and was constantly filling her head with all these stories about what women really were capable of. So, but in the 19th century, women were taught that their proper sphere was the hearth and home, and they weren't supposed to do anything more than take care of their families. And Martha found this appalling, as did, as we were discussing earlier, Frances Seward. Frances was much more was wealthy, so she had servants to take care of all these chores that Martha felt just completely burdened by. 6 children. And then when she was 41, she became pregnant with a 7th, and that was in 1847, and Martha and Lucretia Mott, her sister, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were meeting in Waterloo, New York, and with some other women, and that was where the idea for the Seneca Falls Convention was born, the first convention in America for women's rights as opposed to, you know, abolition. And they planned it for 10 days later, and it occurred, and they invited Frederick Douglass, who was running his abolitionist newspaper, The North Star, out of Rochester. And it was a momentous event. But Martha was still kind of caught between her impulse to rebel and the indoctrination she had received, one key aspect of which, her sister notwithstanding, that women were not supposed to speak in public. So for her entire life, even though she was leading, you know, she went on to lead these abolitionist and women's rights conventions, she was paralyzed by the thought of public speaking. She got good at it, but she hated it.
Well, but apparently had quite an impact when she did finally speak publicly.
She did, and this is the thing. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and then soon Susan B. Anthony were constantly writing about how gifted Martha was. She was a wonderful satirical writer, just bitterly funny, and she much, much more effective than most of these male orators who went on for hours. It could be very dull. She just had a gift for getting right to the point and savaging, you know, things that she just thought were preposterous. So people like William Lloyd Garrison, in addition to Stanton and Anthony and Douglas, just found her to be an incredibly important member of their cabal.
How did David Wright, the man she married, view Martha's work? How much room did he give for it?
Not much. And she wrote about that to her sister Lucretia in very funny ways, too. He came around at the end, but she was arguing in a local party, which was attended by Frances Seward, that she believed that women, this was in around 1840, and she was arguing that women should be paid exactly the same as men were being paid. And think of that. I mean, even today, women aren't paid what men are paid.
Right.
And she was one of the first women to say, you know, that their male outdoor worker should be paid no more than the woman who helped her with the sewing. And because they both needed money to save up for when they were retired. And David just was so irate. He left the conversation. She was arguing with him afterward, and he just left the conversation and walked off in a huff to hoe his asparagus.
So Frances, as you mentioned, Frances Seward, married to William Henry Seward. She called him Henry, which, by the way, when I read the New Yorker piece, it was like, who's this Henry? I had to go back and refresh my memory that, yeah, she called him
Henry. I know, people get confused, but all of his close, his family and everyone called him Henry, so mm-hmm. That's what I called him.
So a big moment in their lives, they met Thurlow Weed in a rather interesting circumstance, and that had a big effect on their lives.
It did, and it totally changed the trajectory of their married life. So when Frances married Seward, she was only 19, and he was a local lawyer. And she thought that, like her father, who was a lawyer who became a judge, Seward would be content to stay in Auburn and, you know, be an upstanding member of the community. And he meets Thurlow Weed, who runs a newspaper, and is very, very ambitious and is really obsessed by politics. And he influences Henry to become equally obsessed with politics, and the two become these very close partners. Basically, Weed likes doing all the backroom maneuvering, and he sees the potential in Seward to become a truly great politician. And Seward hated litigation. He just thought it was just too boring for words. He thought politics were the big business of the country, the most important business of the country. And he started running for office when he was a very young man, and it was one success after another. So from the state legislature to the governorship to U.S. Senator to Secretary of State.
Now, along the way, though, there was a real eye-opener for both of the Sewards, and that was a trip to Virginia in 1835. And set the scene for us. What did they observe there?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. And so they only had two young boys at the time. That was very, very relatively early in their marriage. And so Frances was already very anti-slavery, as Henry was. But she had never been south. She had not. So they head south. And when they were in Virginia, the biggest slaveholding state, they pulled up at a country inn, and they heard the sounds of sobbing and moaning and looked over and saw a slaver carrying a whip, guiding, I think, a dozen little boys who were tied together by a rope and he led them to a horse trough to drink, and then, you know, threw them into a shed where they, whereas Frances wrote in her journal about this, they sobbed themselves to sleep. And she was extremely sensitive. She was one of these very empathetic people who could feel other people's pain as her own. And she wrote in her journal, "Slavery, slavery, I could not get that image out of my mind." And that, so by the time they got back to Auburn, she decided to devote herself fully as she could to abolition.
And indeed she did. And so we'll hear in the next segment about how far ahead of the curve they were in some cases about abolition, where the Sewards, they are among the figures in the book, The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights, the book by Dorothy Wickenden, the executive editor of The New Yorker, that details these efforts of these women to make life better for millions and millions of people. We'll come back to the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. You are welcome to join in by phone at 800-838-3760 or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Back with the Agitators, Dorothy Wickenden, and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dorothy Wickenden, the executive editor of The New Yorker, the author of a new book called The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights. They are Harriet Tubman, Frances Seward, and Martha Wright. And they were people who really did not like the situation they found leading up to the Civil War, where white people could own black people and women could own nothing. Just about nothing in most states. And they fought hard to make sure that people got their rights secured, even if they didn't see it completely finished in their lifetimes. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So back to Frances Seward and her husband, William Henry Seward of Seward's Folly, later Secretary of State and everything. Governor of New York, he's elected in 1838. And where on the spectrum of abolition were the Sewards publicly?
Well, of course, to the South, he was a complete and total renegade, a very dangerous man, because he spoke really openly about how slavery ultimately had to be extinguished, and that was the differentiation that caused a rift between him and Frances. She believed in immediate abolition. He thought it had to happen gradually. Nevertheless, he was really progressive. So he believed in opening public schools to black children and immigrants. He spoke out against religious discrimination. And again, he really, really spoke strongly after he was elected, not when he was running for the job, because he didn't want people to know quite how radical he was. And he spoke very strenuously about slavery and the evil it represented in this country.
Is that why he had one term as New York governor?
Yeah, well, that he was also a terrible spendthrift, so he burned through the budget very quickly, and he also racked up enormous personal debts. He loved extravagant entertaining, and this was another thing that Frances couldn't stand, because that was the way he glad-handed, and he got to know all the important people, and he persuaded them that he was going to be the best politician they ever met. So he did that in Albany, and then by the time he got down to Washington, he had perfected the art, and he would request Frances to come down during Washington's social season and act as his hostess. So he was an absolutely brilliant politician, but she did not like that aspect of politics at all. She wanted to work from the outside.
Well, and then when she got to Washington with him to get him set up there, another awakening, which I suspect she'd had already if she'd been to further south to Richmond and environs. But describe the visible presence of the slave trade in Washington D.C. in the 1840s.
Yes, and that was another thing. She couldn't stomach it. It literally made her ill. She would be driving in her carriage along the Mall and see coffles of enslaved people being driven to one of the slave pens on the National Mall, where they were sold at auction. So it was, Washington was perhaps the biggest slave mart in the entire country, and she was disgusted. She just couldn't abide being there, and she couldn't stand. It was a very southern town, extremely hierarchical. The women she met were southern women, because southerners had held power in Washington for as long as anyone could remember. And she just felt like a complete hypocrite at Henry's very fancy parties, with, you know, multi-course dinners, where she had to, you know, pretend to be a simpering belle. It just wasn't who she was. And, of course, she had nothing in common with these women. I mean, she disagreed with everything they stood for.
Well, not just that. She had a huge role in her husband's work. I mean, this is a true partnership, you know, not just an arranged marriage, people who actually loved each other and trusted each other. And how much did Henry rely upon Frances for getting ready for speeches in the Senate, for example?
Yeah, so it's a fascinating marriage because intellectually, they really respected each other. They read the same books. They had wonderful cerebral conversations. And philosophically, they agreed on just about everything. So whenever she was in Washington and Henry was working on a speech, he would give it to her, and actually it happened in Albany, but when he was elected governor, you know, she worked on his inaugural speech there, and she, at every step of the way, she encouraged him to be true to his conscience and don't compromise. That she says later on, you know, compromise, that word is becoming hateful to me, because that in the Compromise of 1850, you know, that was the idea, that the country could be held together with what, yet one more agreement with the South that would ensure that, for the short term at least, slavery would remain legal in the states where it already was legal.
And one of the facets of the Compromise of 1850 was, of course, the Fugitive Slave Act. And how much did that light a fire under Harriet Tubman? How did she change what she did?
It really lit a fire under Tubman. She said, she told one friend that once that passed, she would no longer trust Uncle Sam with her people. And so at that point, that was really the catalyst for her to begin her Underground Railroad extractions. And it was her way of physically, she was a woman of action, and it was her way of physically removing the foundations from slavery, basically one person at a time. And she believed, this is part of her visions, she believed that God was speaking directly to her, and so she evinced no fear at all. And people trusted her because she was so successful. She later said, I never lost a passenger on the Underground Railroad, and that's more than most conductors can say. So she became, you know, the person she really turned out to be. That was the catalyst. And then, of course, after when the war began in 1861, the Underground Railroad stopped operating. And after about a year into the war, she decided she had to go down to Port Royal, which was now occupied by the Union forces, and work with the army to liberate the enslaved people there.
She insisted upon that, I understand. Basically, they had to create a position for Harriet Tubman?
They did. And she, you know, again, she was such a, she herself was a natural politician. She was a great strategist. And as I said, she knew how to get to know the most important people. So by then, she knew all the major abolitionists in Boston. She hadn't yet met the governor, who was an abolitionist himself. She got one of her friends to get her in to speak to the governor, and Governor Andrew, his name was, and she basically convinced him that she could play a role that no one else could play down there because she had 10 years of experience infiltrating enemy territory, all completely true. He, of course, knew of her exploits, and so he did the paperwork that gave her permission to, you know, cross military lines and go down there. And she, once she was there, she very quickly got to know the key generals, Union generals, and convinced them that she could be a spy. And if they would give her a little money, she could have her own little force of scouts who could help her. They were sort of, basically, the Union troops were surrounded on three sides by Confederates. They were very closed in. So these scouts and Harriet would suss out where the enemy positions were, And eventually, the generals down there just designed a series of river raids, which were very successful. And she went on the most important of them, up the Cumbie River. They stopped at several plantations with the first black troops of the war. They were very poorly defended. The troops got out. They burned the plantation houses, and they made off ultimately with 750 enslaved people on their three little gunboats, and brought them back to Beaufort, South Carolina. And the able-bodied men were immediately enlisted into the army. So this was the beginning of the black troops being allowed to fight for their own freedom. And Tubman had thought from the beginning of the war that there was no way the Union could win unless the black men were allowed to fight in the war. And here she is, a black woman, helping to lead this raid. It's just remarkable. So that's part of the story about Harriet Tubman that I hadn't really known about until I started this book.
No, that's amazing stuff. We have an email here from Sherry in Eugene who wants to know if Martha Coffin Wright is related to Levi Coffin. She says, I am as well, the descendant of Underground Railroad helpers. And is it possible to purchase a signed copy of the book, asks Sherry in Eugene.
It is possible. Probably the best way to do it, Sherry, is you can write to me at dorothy_wickenden@newyorker.com. And I have some copies here, and I'll sign it for you and send it back.
Okay. Dorothy_Wickenden at New York. Is it thenewyorker.com or just newyorker.com?
Just newyorker.com.
Okay. Wanted to come back to Harriet, too. We talked about the fact that she did go back to the eastern shore of Maryland. And for people who are wondering, when we say eastern shore, it's the Delmarva Peninsula. It's the part across Chesapeake Bay. Yeah.
It's the Delmarva Peninsula.
And so... So she wanted to go bring her husband out. Harriet was married, but when she went back to get him, what did she discover?
Well, I don't know how many of your listeners have seen the movie Harriet, which has, it's Hollywood, so a lot of it is heavily fictionalized, but actually that scene is pretty close to what happened. She went back, as she told her friends, with a new set of clothes, and she was so excited. She'd been away for, I can't remember, a year or 2 years, and she was convinced that when she went back and she talked to him, she would say, look, I've got an apartment or a room in Philadelphia. I've got a good job. This is a city where, black people walk around the streets free. They have jobs. This is the future of America. So she goes down. She gives word to her intermediary that she's there, and he refuses to see her. And she tells her friend, one of the friends in the North, I was so angry. I was going to go right in there and make all the mischief I could. And then she said, but then I thought better of it. And I thought, no, I've got a different mission. I'm not going to be a married woman. I am going to, help liberate my people. So instead of taking her husband back, she takes other people who really wanted to get out of there, enslaved people. And that was the beginning, that was part of her mission.
Do we know, even today, how it was that Harriet first connected with Frances Seward and Martha Wright?
Yes, so it's not, this is not absolutely nailed down, but the historians who have written about Lucretia Mott and a few others have said, and I agree, that it had to have been through Lucretia Mott, because Harriet, walks 100 miles out of slavery to Philadelphia, which she had heard was a free city where people could get jobs and, black children could go to school. And so she settled there for the first couple of years, and she immediately went about, as she tended to do, getting to know all of the abolitionists in town, because she wanted to find out how the Underground Railroad worked there. What was the network like? How could she begin to start her operations? Again, this is 1849 or so. One of the first people she meets is Lucretia Mott, Martha's older sister. And then it must have been that on one of Martha's trips, she went down to see her family at least once or twice a year. On one of her trips to see Lucretia, Lucretia would have, because this is how the railroad worked, through connections. So it was like an old girls' network in this particular case. So she would have introduced Harriet to her sister Martha, and then been told about Auburn, which was midway in, on the Underground Railroad, her, on what became her Underground Railroad route in New York State, across New York State. And then Martha, when Harriet came through Auburn, Martha introduced her to Frances.
So when we look back at the how Harriet got set up in Auburn, she ended up buying a house, and it was through a deal set up by the Sewards, wasn't it?
Yes, and that was, I'm so proud of this, because every other historian has said that William H. Seward sold Harriet Tubman a house. That, I don't believe, is true, because think of it. Seward was in Washington. Frances was in Auburn. That was in 1849. She had known Harriet Tubman for almost 10 years. She knew intimately her stories about her family, whom Harriet had rescued and taken up to Canada. Her parents were ill, elderly, and did not like living in a foreign country. It was so cold. And Frances, who had a great family feeling herself, decided that she had renounced her duties as Seward's hostess. She went back to Auburn, and that spring she decided, there is one really important thing I can do for this woman I adore. I can sell her a house down the street, which would be a much more convenient location for her and her family. She could then bring her parents and some of her other relatives down to live in this farmhouse. And then it just made everything that much easier for Harriet Tubman. So again, as you mentioned earlier, this is completely against the Fugitive Slave Act. Frances risked, you know, very heavy fine and possible imprisonment. And it was not done. It was only recently that women in New York had been granted the privilege of inheriting their own property and spending their money as they saw fit. So she did. And Henry agreed with it. But he was running for president, mm-hmm. and he conveniently managed to be, you know, in Europe and Palestine.
Of course, yeah. It's an amazing book, The Agitators by Dorothy Wickenden. Thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thank you.